A birthday is a pretty important day, especially when it's the birthday of the church. Welcome to Sunday Insight, a synopsis of the worship experience here at Wayzata Community Church. Today is Rally Sunday, and we're looking at the second chapter of Acts, where we read and hear about the birth of the church. So let's join the congregation already in worship.
Tracy's coming forward to read our passage from Acts 2, but before she reads it, I want to ask you a question. Do you remember the events surrounding your birthday? Do you remember the events surrounding your birth itself? Well, probably not, right? But so let me ask you differently. Do you remember what people told you about the events surrounding your birth? I know I do. I mean, it's one of the stories we tell over and over again in my family, that within just a moment or two of my birth, literally all the lights went out. And not just in the hospital, but it was a three-state blackout that affected 3 million people. I'm not taking credit for that. supposed to bring light into the world, right? That's what, not darkness. But those of that event and all kinds of other events in and around my birth and around the birth that we all experience, really, those shape our lives from that time forward. They begin to create the narrative that we live into or that we have to live out of. The things that happen in and around our birth matter, not only to us individually, but as well to the church. The story of the birth of the church is the passage we're going to hear now. Now, we hear this at least once a year. I think we may have already heard it twice this year. But it's a really important story to hear for the same reasons that it's important for us to remember the stories of our own individual births. Now, this is Luke writing the book that we call Acts, right? So Luke wrote the whole gospel of Luke. And he's the one that includes all those details about Jesus' birth and how incredible that was. Luke continues on after the resurrection to talk about the birth of the church, and that's the book of Acts. This is in the second chapter. The day of Pentecost had come. It becomes to us known as the birthday of the church. Seems like a good day today to hear the story again, to reflect on how it's striking us right now today, because it's rally day, right? Good day to kind of take a step back. We got lots of visitors, people typically this time of year visiting church. It's a new program year, school year, all those things. But also because I have a feeling that if you're like me or anybody that you hang around with and talk with, there's at least some low-level measure of disorientation in your life. That there's been some measure of disruption in one way or another, and you're trying to figure out what all that means. That's what we're going to unpack after we hear this now. Listen to the word of God from Acts 2.
When the day of Pentecost had come, they were all together in one place. Now, there were devout Jews from every nation under heaven living in Jerusalem. In our own languages, we hear them speaking about God's deeds of power. All were amazed and perplexed, saying to one another, "What does this mean?" Those who welcomed his message were baptized, and that day, about 3,000 persons were added. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and fellowship, to the breaking of bread and the prayers. All who believed were together and had all things in common. They would sell their possessions and goods and distribute the proceeds to all as any had need. Day by day, as they spent much time together in the temple, they broke bread at home and ate their food with glad and generous hearts, praising God and having the goodwill of all the people. And day by day, the Lord added to their number those who were being saved. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. Thanks be to God.
Would you pray with me, please? Gracious and loving God, as a gift of your Spirit, speak to us. For your servants are listening. Amen. There's a Zen proverb that goes a little something like this. You may have heard variations of it, but as I heard it, it goes like this. At first, the mountain is a mountain, and the river is a river. And then, the mountain is no longer a mountain, and the river is no longer a river. Later, the mountain is a mountain again, and the river is a river again. On the surface, it seems kind of simple and straightforward, but I think the depth of the truth of that little proverb is something that we can mine for the balance of our lives and never fully understand it, much less embrace it. And across wisdom literature, this idea is embraced in developmental learning, but also just in our experiences of the world. Orientation, disorientation, and reorientation is another way of saying it. Orientation, disorientation, and reorientation. It's, you know, the mountain is a mountain, but then the mountain is no longer a mountain, and then the mountain is a mountain again. Found, lost, found again. Or like a compass and a map. So we get real good at using a map and a compass to find our way around in the woods, but then all of a sudden we look up one day and something has happened, and all of a sudden what we see on the map doesn't match what we see in front of us. And we're not sure if the map has changed or what we're looking at has changed. And the compass that used to be able to find true north just spins within its bevel. But then it all eventually seems to work again. That map does match what we see, and true north does appear on the compass that we hold in our hands. There's lots of other images for this idea. There was a little book that came out a few years ago called Who Moved My Cheese? Do you remember this? Had to do with what happens when somebody moves our cheese. Like, I put the cheese in the fridge, and then I went to get it, and it was gone. And the question, who moved my cheese? Pentecost, the passage that was just read, we hear just within those few verses the same kind of move. They were all together in one place. They were oriented to one another. But then all of a sudden, there were all these different voices and different languages. There was a disorientation that happened with this huge diversity of people. But then they came back together again, all together in one place, with glad and generous hearts, singing praises to God. Orientation, disorientation, reorientation. Disorientation is really at the heart of this experience. And disorientation can happen at a variety of levels in our lives, globally, nationally, technologically, religiously, and personally. I mean, we can unpack examples under each of those categories and be here for like 3 days. But you know what I'm talking about, the disorientation that happens globally when we're having to revisit again controlling nuclear arms. It's disorienting. Or when earthquakes shake the earth or storms swell the seas, those disruptions don't adhere to national borders. They are global. But there's national disorientation that happens as well. The disruption that comes with every election. The election in 2008 was disorienting. We had a person of color for the first time in our highest office. Regardless of which side of the aisle you sit on and who you voted for, that was disruptive and disorienting. The election of 2016. Again, regardless of which side of the aisle you sit on or how you voted, it has been a disorienting time since last November. Economies within nations can disrupt and disorient, whether it's through boom, like the 90s and all that tech money that was just plowing into people's bank accounts. I remember playing golf with a buddy, and at the end of the round, he said, hey, I just made $2 million today. That's disruptive. It's disorienting. or 2008, when an economy turns and heads into a recession, a soft depression, whatever it may have been. It's disorienting, and social issues within a nation. Who wasn't completely disoriented when we saw people that looked a lot like us wearing chinos and polos, putting forth the hatred of racism that we thought we had at least dealt with in polite conversation? Disorienting. Globally, nationally, technologically, I can't even go there. 10 years since the smartphone was invented. That's it. It's only been 10 years. Can you imagine what that is going to mean 500 years from now? Because 500 years ago, we invented the printing press. We could put everything on paper, including the Bible. That was 500 years ago. The smartphone was just 10 years. And I think Moore's law is right on. I mean, everything doubles constantly, like every day. Boom, 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 boom. Disruptive and disorienting. Religiously, the whole Jesus event was disruptive and disorienting. Not only back then, but when followed rightly now, today, is still disorienting and disrupting. Think about the Romans. When people started talking about Jesus as Son of God, that wasn't possible. The Son of God was in Rome. That was Caesar. That's who that was. Now the Romans, disoriented, disrupted. The Jews, carrying forth this faith and one of their own, is challenging every bit of it and just asking questions that weren't allowed to be asked. How about the disciples and Jesus' family? Talk about disrupted and disoriented. Wow. And personally, you know, the personal disorientation, I think, is the one that we all feel most often every day when a friend is diagnosed with cancer, and we can't possibly imagine life without her. Or a death happens on a highway just a couple hundred feet from where we're sitting right now. Or a divorce that happens within a marriage or within a friendship. These things disrupt us and disorient us. The philosophers will refer to these as events, right? So these things that happen in life that send us one way or another, at least for sure, in a different disoriented way. Theologians will call it maybe an apocalypse, not the apocalypse with a capital A, but an apocalypse. The kind of events that happen actually again and again and again. And like basic elements of fire, wind, or water, there's potential for good in these events, but there's also potential for harm. Fire, wind, and water. Fire is good. It can heat our homes. It can cook our food, but it can also burn down our houses. Wind, we can harness incredible power from wind. Whether we're in a boat or out in an Iowa cornfield beneath a turbine. But a wind can also blow over your barn. And water, we need water just to survive. I mean, we cannot survive without water, and yet too much water. We see what's happening right now in the Keys of our nation. There is good potential. There is harm potential. There's that mix. Here's a silly analogy I'll make for you, okay? This afternoon, my 14-year-old son Logan and I are gonna go in together on a 14-foot fishing boat. We're gonna buy a boat, the two of us together, right? And what I've heard since the day I moved to Minnesota, right? The best day you own a boat, right? The day you buy it and the day you sell it, right? So there's great, huge potential for good, but we know there's gonna be all kinds of headaches along the way. Silly, microcosmic look at what I'm talking about as it relates to disruption and disorientation. So what are we to do then? Because the goal of life and faith is to stay grounded, to stand firm. We want to be able to survive and thrive in the midst of these disruptions. We want to be able to stand firm in the midst of storms that don't just literally and physically wipe things out, but emotionally, spiritually, and religiously. What are we to do to hold all that together? Well, I think at least one thing that we can do for a few moments is just remember our own birth. To look back at the birth of the church and to see it as an event all in its own, as a disorientation, as a time when the people of God were oriented, then disoriented, then reoriented. I looked at the way this kind of lined out, and I realized that what they did and that what we're called to do is to go into this disorientation and name it, and then claim it, and then proclaim it. To name it. We just have to name the disorientations of our life. I already did that just a moment ago. Just running through all those. Now, I didn't name yours because I don't know yours, but you do. Name the disorientation of your life today. Acknowledge it. Acknowledge that the mountain is no longer a mountain and the river is no longer a river. Name it and hold it with non-judgmental observation. Just name it. Like the people did at Pentecost, they were disoriented and disrupted by this huge diversity of people. All these different people they'd never seen before. And all of Jerusalem was watching. And all their heads were turning on, what is going on there? And they themselves were saying, what does this mean? It was breaking news then, and it's breaking news now. The disorientation of the people had to do with all these different people coming together, and so they just named it. And they held it without judgment. They didn't say, oh, you Cretans, you can't be here. They didn't say, oh, you Arabs, you gotta go away. Or you Easterners, whatever religion you are, you can't be here. No, they were all together in one place, and they held together in one place with non-judgmental observation. It's from that very diversity that the strength grew. It's from that very diversity that grace found expression. Do you know that grace is both a noun and a verb? Yeah, grace as a noun means the free, unmerited favor of God. That's beautiful. But grace as a verb is even better. As a verb, it means to honor someone by your presence. When we can name our disorientation and do so in the presence of other people, then we can stand together in grace, honor one another with our presence and a non-judgmental observation. That's what it means to name it. What's it mean to claim it then? Well, once we've named the disruption and we've held it with grace, a non-judgmental observation, then we claim it so that it has potential to shape us and change us, inspire us, inform us, so that in short, we can learn from it. To claim it. To claim the fact that the mountain is no longer a mountain and the river is no longer a mountain. But then what does that mean? Like the people asked at Pentecost, what's all this mean? And without the pressure of having some pat answer, just hold that mystery, hold that ambiguity, and let it shape us and ooh, watch this, remake us from within. I've heard that somewhere. If we don't claim it, by the way, it's going to just eat us from the inside out. If we don't claim it, if we don't learn from it. I tell you, one time I went to Chipotle after church, and I went through the line, you know, and you go through the whole line, and then your food is ready, and then you have to pay for it, right? So afterwards, you get your food, it's all ready, and you pay for it then, and my credit card didn't work. And the really sweet guy behind the counter said, well, do you have any cash? Uh-oh, here we go. I didn't have any cash on me, but I knew full well I had a $10 bill stashed in the console of my car. I could have walked out there and gotten that 10 and made good with Chipotle, but I didn't. I just said, no, I don't have any cash. He said, well, then go ahead, enjoy your burrito. And he sent me off my burrito. I went home and I ate my burrito, and then my burrito ate me. From the inside out, I could barely stand it. Because in an honest moment, we claim it. We learn from it. and we go away different as a result. That's what was happening on Pentecost as well. They were claiming it. They were growing from it. They devoted themselves to the apostles, it says, their teaching and their fellowship. Rustin Comer is a gifted teacher, and he has put together one heck of a plan for you as adult learners to engage your faith in teaching. And in fellowship, it says, Danielle Jones is the latest great gift to this congregation, her ability to build relationships with people and put people together in engagement and in fellowship. Give yourself over to that, especially in the midst of your disorientation. Claim it. Learn from it. Be remade from within. And then finally, proclaim it. Name it, claim it, and proclaim it. Proclaim it just means to share it with somebody else. It might be the most important thing we do with the things that we learn and the stuff that we have is to share it generously with others. In Acts, they talk about, you know, having all things in common, and they fed one another, they shared their resources, all that kind of stuff. But there's another kind of sharing, and it's the sharing of the wisdom that we learn. Even when we don't think the mountain is a mountain anymore and the river's not a river anymore. When we proclaim it, we begin the process of blessing the whole world with that which we now know but didn't know before. Was there a time in your life when you realized something, like you had this moment of clarity and you're like, oh, that's what that's all about, or oh, that's what that means? Or more specifically, do you remember a time when you're talking with somebody and all of a sudden you realize what the heck it was they were talking about 2 years ago when they said something about what was going on in their heart when their mom died? Or when they found out that their spouse had cancer. Or when they remembered what happened in their family through a time of divorce and separation. And then you realize, oh, I've heard this before, but it went in one ear and right out the other. We proclaim that, even if in that moment, it does just that again, in one ear and out the other. Because in time, that proclamation will take hold. And we'll realize that we aren't the first person to go through this. That we can learn from other people, we can learn from one another, and we can be blessed by the ways in which we share it. It says that they had all things in common. And they didn't just live together, but they loved together. A new command. This is how we do it. My friends, the church was born this way. We've just heard the account in Acts 2. The church was born this way. The church was born with grace and growth and generosity. It was born to deal with disruption and disorientation by naming it and claiming it and proclaiming it. And we are the church now here today. Next Sunday, we're going to start a series that's really going to go deeper and deeper into what it means to be the church. Don't just go to church. Be the church. It's going to have something to do with naming, claiming, and proclaiming the disruptions of our lives and recognizing that a life of faith is the acknowledgement that life is itself one perpetual disorientation and disruption after another. But through it all, we have the steady love, grace, and presence of God. Would you bow with me, please? Gracious and loving God, give us the courage to ask the question of the early church, of what does this mean? The disorientations of our lives, what does it mean? Help us to hold that, to embrace that, to let it remake us from within, and then to send us different and ready to respond to it in ways that matter not only to our world, but more importantly, oh God, in ways that matter to you. May it be so. Amen.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Sunday Insight. Wayzata Community Church is a United Church of Christ congregation that welcomes all people into every aspect of our ministry and full membership of our church, believing deeply that discrimination and exclusion in any form is incompatible with Christ's message of unconditional love. If you'd like to learn more about Wayzata Community Church, please visit our website, follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, or download our weekly podcast. We offer 5 worship services each week. 8 a.m. with communion in our chapel, 9 a.m. and 10:45 a.m. and Parables, special needs worship service in the chapel at 10:30 a.m. every Sunday. We also offer full adult and children's programming every Wednesday, including WOW, worship on Wednesday at 6:15 p.m. in the sanctuary. And we'll see you in church.